Welcome to this week's Breezy Breakfast. Today's topic is community wealth, a different approach to community development. The goal of local economic stability is achieved by such strategies as anchoring jobs locally, empowering workers, and establishing community land trusts. What role could institutions such as the University of Guelph and the Guelph General Hospital play in building community wealth? What are the advantages of employee-owned businesses and worker cooperatives? How do community land trusts contribute to the stability and affordability of communities? What about public finance? Community wealth starts with buying and hiring locally. What are the next steps in building a more resilient community? What are the guiding principles of community wealth candidates? Our guest, Colin Bruce Anthes, answers our questions and gives examples of how community wealth has stabilized cities punished by globalization and made companies more resilient to economic shocks. And now, over to longtime listener and first-time moderator, Kevin Bowman.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us at another Breezy Breakfast. Today, we are joined by Colin Bruce Anthes, which he is a organizer with Community Wealth Candidates. So we're going to spend some time talking about what is community wealth and what is Community Wealth Candidates. Welcome, Colin. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
And just before we dive into it, I'm going to give a land acknowledgement. So the city of Guelph resides on the treaty lands and territories of the Mississaugas of the Credit. We recognize this gathering place where we work and learn is home to many past, present, and future First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. Our acknowledgement of the land is our declaration of our collective responsibility to this place, its peoples, histories, rights, and presence. A Breezy Breakfast adds our collective voice to the calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Committee on Indian Residential Schools to never forget, to hold governments and colonial forces to account, and to seek redress and healing for the injustices of the past and those that continue to this day. All right. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Colin. Colin, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you got involved with community wealth?
Absolutely. So I grew up without any interest in politics or economics whatsoever, but I'm 35 and I started to become interested in politics circa George W. Bush. I started to become interested in economics circa 2008. That was the beginning of the end of history, as it were. And like many people my age, I, in the immediate moment, started studying the spectrum as it was presented to me, which was governments versus markets, from Joseph Stalin to Boris Yeltsin. And I think like most people who study that spectrum, I came out as sort of Finland seems nice social democrat. But about 10 years ago, I learned first what a worker cooperative was, and then started to learn about enterprises that were not controlled by the government, but did not have the traditional division of workers and owners that we see with a capitalist enterprise. Worker-owned companies, democratic worker cooperatives, member and consumer cooperatives like credit unions, food co-ops, housing co-ops. Around the world, there are a billion members of cooperatives. And they have above average rates of success across the boards and made things a lot more practical. In particular, the way the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation handled the 2008 recession really kind of, for me, put a nail in the coffin for any allegiance to standard capitalist modes of production. And I can get into that a little more as we go along. But that changed my own hands-on practice and my research tremendously. And a few years later, I learned about work that was being done in Cleveland, Ohio, to bring anchor institutions and worker cooperatives in different ways of members holding wealth in common, members of a community holding wealth in common, bringing them together to help support each other in really clear, coherent ways. And they were lifting people out of poverty in a kind of post-industrial setting. And it was having such profound impact that community wealth initiatives were taking off across the United States and in England as well. And these communities that were using them very productively looked a lot like my own community. I live in St. Catharines, Ontario, which is an old General Motors site. And we've had the same kind of struggles that a lot of these other communities had. And these were very productive ways forward, a different approach to development, both in the short and long term. And so this became a primary focus of mine. And so for about the last 6 years, I've been very involved with community wealth building as a researcher, as an activist, as a practitioner. And over the last year, I've had the great pleasure of working with a number of volunteers to build community wealth candidates. And I can talk a little bit about community wealth candidates next if you'd like. But that's how I come to the work, really through learning about the different ways that members of a community can hold wealth in common, and then finding out productive examples that were happening in the world today and expanding around the world today.
Oh, excellent. So I've already got several prompts I want to follow up on. So we'll definitely bring up Mondragon again, and we'll definitely bring up community wealth candidates again. But before that, just so that we're all kind of on the same page, let's define community wealth. Like, what is it and what kind of problems is it trying to address?
Yeah, absolutely. So community wealth building is a term that was coined by the Democracy Collaborative in the United States, and they're the architects of the Cleveland model of community wealth, which, as I said, was first used to pull people out of poverty in a very poor part of Cleveland, Ohio. And that model today is about 4.5 times the size it was when it started about 15 years ago. So it's actually had rapidly expanding success. A larger version of that was taken across the pond to Preston, England, which went on to be named the most improved city in the United Kingdom 2 years in a row. And since then, initiatives have been building around the world. Actually, I just found out a couple of days ago, Kevin, you won't know this from our previous correspondence, but just recently I learned that the strategic plan for the for HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department in the United States, has community wealth building built into the new strategic plan. That's a $68 billion strategic plan. So it's rapidly scaling around the world. The premise is very simple. First, we look at the different ways members of a community can hold wealth in common. A community of workers owning the company that they work for, having access to that company's profits, the best version of which is a worker cooperative because it's also democratic. That's a fantastic example of a community holding wealth in common. A community land trust. We talk about housing a bit superficially in Canada. We talk about it like it's all about the physical structures of housing. But actually what really causes the cost of housing to skyrocket are the land values under the housing. That's why the same house in one community can cost twice as much as an identical building out in the boonies. A community land trust takes a plot of land off the market and under the permanent control of a local nonprofit, usually to provide permanent intergenerational affordable housing, but technically it can be used to provide affordable access to any kind of development that community might want, a cultural enterprise, cooperative enterprise, community gardens. So it's a very versatile form of community wealth. And then anchor institutions. We often don't realize, much to our detriment, just how much potential progressive investment we have at our disposal. Because in all of our communities, we have large nonprofits, public, quasi-public enterprises, like religious institutions, performing arts centers, schools, universities, colleges, libraries. They all have to purchase lots of goods and services from outside organizations. They're often purchasing them from capitalist corporations that are multinational corporations. A few people get the profits, they stave them in offshore tax havens, the wealth completely disappears. But they're also mandated to organize on a nonprofit basis, and they can be organized to purchase intentionally locally for community benefit. So these are some of the different ways that members of a community can hold wealth in common. To give some of the core examples that we focus on, the stroke of genius that the Democracy Collaborative had in the United States was they showed how those different kinds of pieces could be brought together to support each other in a complex. So that, for instance, you could have your credit unions, your cooperative banks, and your municipal governments offering seed grants to start worker cooperatives in your community. You could have your anchor institutions purchasing goods and services from those worker cooperatives, the profits going into the hands of many local democratic worker owners who in turn are going to continue to purchase locally. That money is going to keep circulating in your economy, doing good things. And then as the prosperity grows and the property values go up and the land values go up, you've got your community land trust there to capture a portion of them, keep people from being pushed out through gentrification, and make sure that those land values are going back into the community. And so you can have the whole gamut. You can have the good democratic jobs, the good investment, the affordable housing in perpetuity. And that's what the Democracy Collaborative was starting to do in Cleveland, bringing together anchor institutions and worker cooperatives. That's what was taken on a much larger scale to Preston, England. That's what's expanding around the world. These ways of holding wealth in common and then using them to build off of each other and support each other. for good local development, democratic local development. And that's what's now being really scaled up around the world.
Excellent. All right. Thank you so much for that fairly comprehensive breakdown. You mentioned several components there to what mm-hmm. community wealth is. I'm wondering if we can dive into a couple of those.
Absolutely.
Let's start off with, you mentioned employee ownership and cooperative enterprises, particularly worker co-ops.
Yes.
Can you expand a bit on how that particular pillar of community wealth contributes to the overall goals and purpose of community wealth?
Yeah, absolutely. In a few different ways. One, it's a great way for members of a community to hold wealth in common. Another is it brings democracy into play in places where they where often there is no democracy. We often have what David Friedman calls competitive dictatorship. He says that as an advocate of competitive dictatorship, dictatorial companies in which workers are organized from above to labor for the profits of a few people and competing with each other, or having a monopoly and not competing with each other, as the case may be. So sometimes it's worse than that. But a worker-owned company, there are different kinds of worker-owned companies. There are ones in which the workers simply own shares. Like ESOPs are typically not that democratic. They can be democratic, but ESOPs are typically focused more on employee ownership more broadly. They're associated with higher wages, greater job security and longevity, and the companies tend to be more successful. So they do a lot of good, and they're very important right now, because what we are facing is what's sometimes called the silver tsunami. And what that means is we have all of these baby boomer entrepreneurs who started these companies. Now they're employing a lot of people, but those entrepreneurs are retiring and they don't have succession plans. So those companies are often closing, or they're simply being sold to somebody from outside the community who then fires all the workers, maybe liquidates the assets. And so that's currently destabilizing the workforce on a very large scale. It could be doing exactly the opposite. A lot of companies are now transferring into employee ownership as their succession plan. And what we're finding, there's studies in Europe, we don't have ones over here yet that speak to this. But in Europe, what we're finding is that those companies that transfer to employee ownership are 60% more likely to continue to succeed in the years ahead rather than close down. And so it's a great way of stabilizing the enterprises, which are often local community hubs and are built into the fabric of the community, but also stabilizing those jobs and giving people higher wages and job security. We can be doing exactly the opposite with employee ownership. A worker cooperative is a company in which the workers don't just own the company. They have democratic participation in the policy of that company. Now, typically worker cooperatives are things that start from the ground up as cooperatives. So we are seeing some transition of existing enterprises into worker cooperatives. More commonly, we're seeing existing enterprises transition into ESOPs. But we see a lot of companies being started as worker cooperatives by people who want to engage in their work as co-owners of the company that they work for, with democratic participation in those companies. And around the world, worker cooperatives are found to have above average rates of success. Here in Canada, they're twice as likely as your standard startup enterprise to last 10 years or more. So they're a wonderful mode of having a more just economy, but also they're very practical. Every community should be looking to facilitate worker cooperatives and to promote them as activity in their community.
Excellent. You mentioned ESOP a couple of times. Could you just break down what that is, define that for us?
Yeah, that's a stock option, an employee stock option. And so that's simply a shareholding arrangement in which workers own shares in the company that they work for, so that in addition to their wages, they're getting a piece of the profits that come from that company as well. Those do not always come with, I mean, they're often minority shareholders, and so they often do not have much in terms of democratic participation in steering the company. But more and more we're seeing that change as people ask those questions. Once you've got a foot in the door, can we build this company in a more democratic basis all the way through? And we're starting to see ESOPs becoming more democratic over time.
Okay, fantastic. And a follow-up to that, so organizations that are organized as an employee stock option or a cooperative, do they have any kind of advantage in terms of like retaining institutional knowledge? You mentioned the silver tsunami of boomers who are business owners and are approaching retirement. And, you know, they're going to take a lot of experience and knowledge with them when they go.
Yes.
Are these structures, these business structures that you're mentioning, are they a little bit better at making that transition smoother?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. So yes, a big thing about worker-owned companies is that the job retention is much higher than it is in your standard enterprise. And that's both because it's a better deal for the workers, but also the workers are not treated as they often are in some companies, as like we see with Amazon, or here in St. Catharines, we have Sitel, which is a call center. Actually, the huge turnover rate of the workers is the business model, right? Like that's how they keep cheap workers on staff, is they churn them out. But that's really bad if you want to have knowledge retention within a company. What we see with these companies is they have much higher rates of job retention. And again, the research that I have on this is from Europe. I don't have the research in North America yet, because I haven't seen that it's been produced. But the evidence is that these companies are much more successful if they transition to employee ownership. This is being done on, I should mention, it's being done on very large scales. So probably the biggest scale that I know of a company transitioning into employee ownership and on a really democratic basis is the John Lewis partnership in Britain. People might know of John Lewis because they have Christmas commercials that go viral every year. People might have seen the commercial of Elton John going back through time through his various pianos until he gets his first keyboard Christmas morning. It's a huge retail company, massive British retail company that was handed down to its workers about 100 years ago by a progressive entrepreneur. Today it has 85,000 worker owners. And they democratically elect positions like managers, boards of directors. They have 3,000 democratically elected positions. And when they turn a profit, as they usually do, some gets reinvested into the company and some gets redistributed to the entire workforce that produced that profit in the form of a company bonus. And so the result is they have retention rates that are unheard of in retail, like just absolutely unheard of. So this works on a very large scale. Recently, Bob's Red Mill in the United States, one of the main producers of whole grains in North America, has transitioned. Bob's still working there. He's like 94 years old. But when he hit his 80th birthday, he started transitioning that company into an employee-owned company. And now they're 100% employee-owned company. And again, fantastic job retention. Their employees have been staying there for a very long time. So we're seeing really large companies as well as small businesses adapt this as their strategies very, very successfully.
Excellent. And we can chat more about this later, but I'm just going to plug, I have a friend, Sean Gobi, who's a professor at University of Waterloo, and he is in the process of doing studies on these types of businesses where they're transitioning from, you know, a single owner or maybe a family owning to the employees taking over. And In fact, I believe he set up somewhat of like an incubator where they're training a bunch of people to then go out and do workshops with business owners and teach them about this option so that they can take advantage.
That's actually the kind of thing that we have on our list of initiatives that are good for community wealth building. Employee ownership centers, the Ohio Employee Ownership Center in the United States, mostly by reaching out to retiring baby boomer entrepreneurs, has transferred over 20,000 jobs now into employee ownership. So those kinds of initiatives are very, very effective, and that's exactly what we need to see more of.
Amazing. Earlier, you mentioned the Mondragon Cooperative, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is it's actually a federation of many cooperatives that has, you know, billions of dollars
going through its
various companies. And tell us a bit more about Mondragon, and maybe specifically how they weathered the 2008 financial crisis.
It's so important to understand this right now, because we are already preemptively seeing the opposite of what Mondragon did, with Elon Musk announcing a 10% cut at Tesla because he had a super bad feeling about the economy. So preemptively getting rid of workers. So Mondragon is, and you're quite right, it's a large federation. The Mondragon Cooperative Corporation is the umbrella organization under which there are 98 federated worker cooperatives. They were started by five low-income workers and a Catholic priest in the 1950s in the Basque region of Spain. But they started in a very intelligent way. And we have a Community Wealth Candidates has a YouTube playlist of interviews and videos that we've done on community wealth building over the past 9 months. And we have a really great one with Peter Julian, who goes into this in detail. Peter Julian's the House Leader, Federal House Leader of the NDP. He studied at IRCAS, the School of Cooperative Management. So he gives some wonderful details about this. But they first built a credit union, so they had access to loans. They also had a training center, so they had education resources. So they really gave themselves a very strong foundation, and we've seen the rewards of that. Today, Mondragon, starting with 5 employees in the 50s, they have 81,000 employees, democratic worker owners, in 100 federated worker cooperatives. And their bottom employee makes about 3 times as much as the Spanish minimum wage. That's their bottom employee. While their top employee makes 9 times as much as their bottom employee, which is a very good paycheck, but it's not hundreds of times as much as the median employee, which is what we're seeing with corporate CEOs over here right now. So the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation had about 70,000 worker owners, democratic worker owners, in this federated network of worker cooperatives heading into the 2008 recession. When the 2008 recession hit, Spanish unemployment went up to 26%. That is 1% higher than it went at its peak in the United States in the Great Depression. So we're talking like a massive, massive recession over there. And that's because as much as we talk about the risk that your standard capitalist takes on, the truth is when things go down, they immediately start firing the workers to cut costs for the owners. And that's what happened in Spain. Your conventional enterprises with a division of workers and owners were shedding workers like crazy. And so Spanish unemployment went up to 26%. But in Mondragon, they weren't going to do that because the workers were the owners. So they organized a bit differently. Some of the things that they did were, for instance, reducing work weeks while demand was low to 4 days. So workers got a 3-day weekend and 80% of their paycheck and kept their job. And then when demand picked back up again, they went to 5-day work weeks. When one of their companies had to close because it couldn't weather the storm, they started rehiring the workers through the other cooperatives because they had that collective interest. They were able to keep virtually full employment through the biggest recession since the Great Depression. And today they have another 11,000 workers than they did at that time. And so it was a completely different approach that was very natural to them. It wasn't like they were doing something that was outlandish and they had to start from scratch or what have you. This was the natural thing to do. If you don't have that division of workers and owners and you have those democratic inputs, you're not going to just fire everybody because there's a recession. You're going to figure out how to take care of them. That's exactly what they did. And that's something that we need to be talking about more of and how we're going to have more resilient economies moving forward, because the chances are we're going to be facing a recession in the next year. Actually, the current projections, I hate to say it, I love to talk about the uplifting sides of community wealth building, and that's what I'd really love to focus on. But the current projections from so many outlets are that we're going to have a recession followed by stagflation right now. So we have to talk about more resilient ways of working. And that's an example that I think we all have to look at this particular moment.
Yes, agreed. All right, one of the other pillars you mentioned that's a significant part of the community wealth model is anchor institutions.
Yes.
Guelph has several. We've got the university, we've got a hospital, we've got a manufacturer, Linamar, that employs more than 10,000 people in Guelph. I think they're the single largest employer. Can you tell us a little bit more about the role of an anchor institution in the community wealth model?
Yeah, this is so important because we often feel like there's this thing called the economy out there and it's outside of our hands and there's austerity that comes along and we're all underfunded. And actually we have tremendous resources here at home. And this is the thing that is at the heart of community wealth building. Start by looking at what you've already got and what can you build off of that? You might find that you have quite a lot. And as you say, Guelph has a ton of fantastic anchor institutions, really great anchor institutions. These anchor institutions most commonly are used to produce local hiring and local purchasing. So the ethos that it's the Cleveland Foundation first started to bring together a circle of anchor institutions that would commit to an ethos of hire local, buy local, live local. And then it was on that basis that the Democracy Collaborative came in and said, okay, let's start worker cooperatives in this community and see if we can partner them with those anchor institutions and make those worker cooperatives bigger and more prosperous. But the anchor institutions actually came first before the worker cooperatives in the Cleveland model. And what we saw in Preston is anchor institutions investing, we're now talking about hundreds of millions of dollars into their communities using this ethos. to build community wealth in their community. But they can also do other things as well. Like a university can help offer educational resources. I mentioned the Ohio Employee Ownership Center. That's a handful of people working on employee ownership affiliated with Kent State University. Here in Canada, St. Mary's University in Halifax has entire programs on cooperative management, degree programs, graduate programs, certificates. Most of our universities and colleges right now don't have a single course on cooperative management, even though there are a billion members of cooperatives around the world, and they have above average rates of success as enterprises. Before we get into the distribution of wealth, before we get into democratic rights and freedoms, the stability of the economy, just is the enterprise likely to succeed? They have above average rates of success as enterprises, whether we're talking about member cooperatives, consumer cooperatives, or worker cooperatives. So our universities could be offering courses on cooperative management. And that's things that community partners can ask for. That's things that students can ask for, student governments can ask for, and they can get them in their institutions and foster that kind of activity in their community. So anchor institutions can play a number of important roles in their community, but the main one that we focus on is purchasing power, because purchasing power keeps a community insulated from austerity. We don't have to have austerity, even if our bigger government partners aren't working with us, even if the international economy is focused on outsourcing, we don't have to have austerity. We can work to bring together anchor institutions on an ethos of hire local, buy local, live local, and we can get great investment going into the things that we want in our communities.
Excellent. Yeah, it definitely sounds like there's some significant opportunities there for Guelph specifically, but many other communities.
Absolutely.
Another pillar that you mentioned when you were describing community wealth model was public banks or financing. I think most people are familiar with a credit union, a bank that's owned by its customers. But can you tell us a bit more about public banks and financing and what role that plays in the community wealth model?
Yes. Yeah. Great. So first off, credit unions are wonderful to have, and public banks in no way negate credit unions. Credit unions in Canada are a big part of the reason why, and actually I should say, a lot of people are not familiar with this, but the biggest collection of worker cooperatives across Canada or the United States is in Canada, specifically in French Canada, specifically in Quebec. And that's because Alphonse Desjardins started the Caisse Populaire movement, the credit union movement. Today it's the Desjardins Group. It's the biggest collection of credit unions in North America. And they're cooperative banks, which I did get some sort of personal finance advice growing up, but I wish I had known the difference between a cooperative bank and a corporate bank growing up. That would have made a big difference for me. Cooperative banks, of course, give loans to cooperative enterprises that sometimes your standard corporate bank will not give. And so French Canada accumulated worker cooperatives in a proportion that's unseen across Canada or the United States. So credit unions are very, very important. And we should be looking to move more of our banking to credit unions. Public banks give the public an outlet that's usually governed by a government body, often a provincial body or a state body in the United States. Although we are starting to see a move towards municipal public banks, which are really, really interesting. And that gives us the ability to make big democratic decisions at the social level about what kind of investment we're going to have in our society. And I'll mention, this will surprise people, but don't let anybody tell you that Alberta doesn't like socialism, because Alberta has a public bank that is $50 billion in size. $50 billion. The biggest public bank in the United States is the Bank of North Dakota. It's 1/7 the size of the public bank in Alberta. So again, we have a tradition here in Canada that's just unparalleled with public banks. A lot of people don't know it. It's the worker cooperative movement in Quebec, the public bank movement in Alberta, are things that don't necessarily translate or get popularized across the rest of Canada. We can look to these examples here at home. It's one of the best things that the Alberta economy has had going for it over the last 100 years, this fantastic public bank. So it gives us a chance to direct our investments where we want them to go on a very, very large scale, as opposed to leaning on corporate banks, which are usually the big bankers, and they have to make decisions based on what's going to benefit the bottom line of their owners. And that's sometimes going to be completely at odds with what the general public actually wants.
Fantastic. And then, so these public banks or credit unions, as you mentioned, because they're more directly accountable to the community members, they're more likely to be willing to provide seed money or loans to, you know, a small community enterprise, as opposed to TD, which is less likely to do so.
Precisely. So if we want things like worker cooperatives to be building in our communities, we're going to be wanting to look to these non-corporate outlets for our finance. And that's also true in our personal lives. We might not necessarily want our personal finance to be attached to big corporations, but we can connect the two. We can connect our personal finance to these more cooperative and democratic outlets that in turn are going to make it easier to foster other cooperative and democratic outlets.
Excellent. All right, one more pillar of the community wealth model that you mentioned was community land trusts.
Yes.
We had a previous session where we dug into that, so I'm hoping.
Oh, great, fantastic.
Yeah, but that was a rather popular session, so I'm hoping we can dig into it once again and satisfy people's curiosity.
Yes.
Great. Tell us a bit more about the role of community land trusts in the community wealth model.
This is so important. I actually just wrote an article about it very recently. The thing about, so community land trusts, it's very simple. A plot of land is taken off the market on a permanent basis and placed under the control of a local nonprofit. And that nonprofit usually has a board that includes, it might only have a member from each, but it doesn't have to necessarily be a big board, but it includes people who are on the land trust board itself, are stakeholders from the community, often technical experts, but also maybe people who have donated money to the community land trust. And if there are people who are living on the community land trusts, those tenants are usually are on the board as well. And so there is this holistic approach. The community has two votes on that board, which is really, really important. So it's very different from the kind of speculative real estate that we've been seeing insanely over the last couple of years. And what's really important about community land trusts is something I'm trying to really hammer home for people. When we talk about affordable housing, the land value of a house or a living arrangement, it could be a housing cooperative or an apartment or what have you. The land value, depending on what district you're in, accounts for sometimes 20%, sometimes as much as 35% of the value of that property. The standard rule is that for every $3 one pays to a landlord, two are for the building and its maintenance. One is just owning the land underneath that house, which the landlord actually does nothing to produce, which is where they get their profit from. That's the profit margin. So when we talk about most housing, affordable housing initiatives, we're talking about subsidizing that model. And the problem is those land values and those housing values are going up and up and up and up. So what does that mean? It means we have to keep subsidizing and subsidizing and subsidizing more and more and more and more in order to keep up with how housing is inflating. And we've seen that in especially the last couple of years, but in Canada, really for the last couple of decades, on a very large scale, where the demands on subsidies to affordable housing just keep building and building and building and building. With a community land trust, the CLT has permanent control over those land values, which means that the property is permanently linked to the affordability rate. In other words, a subsidy that helps a community land trust purchase that land and create the housing upon it on a community land trust has made a one-time investment that will produce permanent affordable housing through the generations. You only have to do it one time. You don't have to keep inflating the subsidies to keep up with the cost of housing. Once you've made that community land trust investment, boom, you got affordable housing that will outlive the people who are on that board of directors, right? Future generations will have affordable housing. So that's one of the reasons that we really, really need to be talking about it right now as we realize just how unsustainable our current housing practices are. This is it will help immediately in the short term, but it'll also have intergenerational effects. Now, I can get into the technicalities. Were there particular questions about community land trusts that you wanted me to address, Kevin, like some of the inner workings?
Yeah. So let's say you've got a scenario where somebody has successfully formed a community land trust and bought some vacant, underused land. What's the process for them to actually build some housing and ensure that housing doesn't return to the market somehow?
Any kind of development can take place upon a community land trust. It can be housing, it can be a small business, cooperative enterprise, community gardens, what have you. The people who are purchasing properties on that community land trust. You can own a house on a community land trust. This is something that gets a bit confusing. You can develop on a community land trust as long as you have an agreement with the community land trust itself. The community land trust merely owns the land underneath that property. So that means any kind of housing development can take place upon it. It can take place with nonprofit partners. It can take place with the private sector if you want to. People can own their houses on that community land trust, but what's going to happen is they're going to form an agreement that's usually a 99-year lease agreement with the community land trust, in which the terms of that housing arrangement are established, or that including terms of development. And I see some questions popping up in the comments. I'll try to get to those in a moment. But what happens is usually the agreement will say you can have this property at a discounted rate, but when you sell, if you choose to move out of this housing arrangement, say 15 years down the road, quite often it's used to get starter homes for a young family, for instance. You have to cap your profit rate and keep this at the level of affordability for the next people who come in. And that 99-year lease ensures that that will happen for the next people who purchase those houses, even if all the original members of that community land trust are gone by then. That lease agreement will stay true between the current stewards of the community land trust and the next home buyers. So that, for instance, to keep the math super simple, if you had a $500,000 home on a community land trust, it could be purchased for $400,000 from that community land trust. Many years later, let's say that home is now worth $1 million. The first home buyers would sell it for $800,000. They would turn a profit that would allow them to make a down payment on their next home, while the new home buyers would come in at $200,000 under the market price. And so that lease agreement ensures that it's going to continue to filter through the generations, beyond the first buyers, beyond the first community land trust board of directors. And that's what makes it possible to keep it from going back into the market. Does that make sense?
I think so. So perhaps an analogy that folks might be able to wrap their head around a bit more is that the community land trust is an incorporated body, mm-hmm. but it operates as a nonprofit. And they're essentially filling the role of the landlord in a typical private for profit arrangement, but they don't have that profit motive. They're explicitly working against that.
Yes.
And the community land trust, they own the land. They make agreements to let people build or live on the land. So the community land trust would be the one paying municipal taxes, for instance, as opposed to the people living there. Does that make sense?
No, the municipal taxes are still going to be the land as they're set up right now. They're still going to be the land and the property put together. So it's not going to be that the community land trust is paying the taxes separately from the homeowners. In most arrangements, you're going to have they're both going to be involved in the property taxes. But the purchase of the house will be at a highly discounted rate. But typically it varies a bit from one district to another, because you know we do have some differences in the tax policy from one district to another. But typically the taxes are still the property and the land in most jurisdictions. It's the purchasing that's going to be highly discounted.
Okay, got you. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the folks that actually govern the community land trust, like the board of directors, mm-hmm. There's a couple variations on what that could look like. Like the community land trust could be entirely legally separate from the municipality. And
that's correct.
That's the organization. Or alternatively, the municipality could start their own community land trust, where you could have a hybrid model. Like, are these all options?
Yeah, absolutely. What the role that the municipal government, these are fantastic questions. I'll try and cover these as succinctly as I can. Typically, the community land trust is a separate entity from the municipal government, but is often facilitated by the municipal government. So some of the ways that municipal governments and larger governments help community land trusts are they often will donate, rather than control, donate underused land or vacant land to a community land trust. or, and this is something that we also advocate for, they will provide subsidies to help community land trusts purchase land in their community and take it under the control of a community land trust. Now, this is done by many municipalities and by many governments. The most profound example of it that's really working and has been expanded rapidly over time is in Scotland. The Scottish Land Fund, which is produced by the national governments in Scotland, gives £15 million a year in grants to community land trusts to help them purchase land. They started with £10 million and they've gone up to 15 million. That's over 23 million Canadian a year. Adjusted for population, they have less than 6 million people in Scotland. Adjusted for population, that would be the equivalent of $170 million a year subsidy in Canada to help community land trusts purchase land. And they're very committed to it because it has a tremendous success rate. They really like what's going on with community land trusts. So this can be done at a very, very large scale, but we are also seeing municipal governments getting involved on a smaller scale, facilitating community land trusts through donations of land to community land trusts and through subsidies to help them purchase properties in that community. It's more common for a government to get involved in a land bank than a community land trust, which is really looking at lands that are particularly vacant and very badly developed or underdeveloped and trying to get them up to par. So it's more common that you're gonna see the municipality get involved in a land bank than a community land trust. But the community land trust model usually has municipal partners, but is a nonprofit outside of the government itself.
Got you. Could you expand a little bit more on the land bank and what the difference is?
I'll expand a little bit, but I have to admit I'm much less expert on land banks than I am on community land trusts. The fundamental difference is that they start with a vacant piece of land, where a community land trust does not need to start with a vacant piece of land, can start with an existing property with a house on it or an apartment or anything else. And it's usually trying to take something that is a kind of a thorn in the side of the community and to get it up to scale and then build it as a community asset. And so quite often the municipality will take over a piece of land that is currently a thorn in the side of the community and try and turn that into an asset. So land banking is usually starting from that place as a public initiative, whereas a community land trust is a nonprofit initiative that is often partnered with the city, but is not a municipal ownership project.
Excellent, thank you for that. And going back to community land trusts, I think there was an example in Toronto where the city donated some property to Parkdale yes. neighborhood. They're turning that into a community land trust and affordable housing.
That's right, yes. Yeah, for many hundreds of units of permanent affordable housing on the land trust there. Fantastic yeah. example, yeah.
My understanding is that came about essentially by community public pressure. Like the Parkdale yep. community saw this property as a community asset because it was affordable housing, and they saw that it was at risk of disappearing from the community. They were going to lose that, and so they pressured City Hall yes. to take over ownership and then turn it over to the community. Is that essentially what took place?
That's exactly it. Yeah, precisely. Good old fashioned public pressure. And it worked out very, very productively. It's a story of a lot of outrage, but it has, I won't say a happy ending, because actually those community land trusts are continuing to look for opportunity and are continuing to expand and look for opportunities to expand. So the story is of a community land trust is never finished. And that story is one that is not finished, but it's one that has moved to a much happier place as a result of that activity. Yeah, great example.
Well, this is something that we won't dig too much more into it now, just because I'm conscious of time. But we have several chunks of undeveloped or underdeveloped land or old industrial land in Guelph that, we should probably be looking at these options, absolutely. Whether it's land bank or land trusts, to make sure that land is used in a way that is beneficial for us instead of just selling it off to whoever wants to build more subdivisions.
Big time. yeah, big time.
Okay. Well, we've already mentioned a couple real world examples of the community wealth model being implemented. You mentioned Cleveland, Ohio, and Preston, yes. I'm particularly interested in the Preston model because it sounds like they were a bit more multifaceted or comprehensive. Can you tell us a bit more about what happened there?
Yeah, they launched on a very large scale and are continuing to launch on a very large scale. They were bringing in not just anchor institutions, or at least at this point, they have brought in not just anchor institutions to foster local investment, as well as cooperative enterprise. They really focused a lot on member and consumer cooperatives, as well as worker cooperatives and employee-owned companies. But they also have leveraged things like pension funds to procure local investment. And so they've brought in very big players. This is a community, and this is, again, one of those kind of manufacturing communities past what was at least perceived as the prime of manufacturing, really in decline and very difficult straits. One of those communities that we hear of, the ones that really got devastated after Thatcher, this was one of those communities that had been just devastated. And they very quickly, they had been only using community wealth work for a handful of years, about half a decade, when they were named the most improved city in the United Kingdom. And then the next year, they were named the most improved city in the United Kingdom again. So it's been quite a remarkable story. The Preston model is one that has also some wonderful graphics that show exactly the different kinds of enterprises that were being used and leveraged. So I encourage people to do a quick Google search and type in the Preston model, and the actual graphics for the Preston model will pop up, and they can see the inner workings of that model. But it's very comprehensive. They really sat down at the table. It was just, they looked at what had been done in Cleveland and said, okay, the thing that we do is we sit around the table and ask, what are our community assets? What do we got here? And how can they be leveraged to invest and hire and produce good results in our community? And when they sat around the table, they found they actually had quite a lot. Many, many millions of pounds immediately that they could start leveraging for community wealth building. And so it took off very, very quickly. And often we have not just sat around the table and outlined what we've got in our community. The way you did a little while ago is you were starting to say, you know, we've actually got all of these anchor institutions, the university and the hospital and all of these things. If people sit down and make a list and then go, okay, what if we brought these together as partners? They would very quickly realize they could get a lot of investment going in very positive directions in their community, and they could get a very strong cooperative network building in their community that's going to allow them to develop on a very democratic basis, on a long-term basis. So that's exactly what Preston did. And the results have been astonishing. They've changed many, many thousands of lives.
Excellent, excellent. You mentioned that for 2 years in a row, Preston was awarded most improved city in England.
That's right.
Do you happen to know what metrics they were, like what were they measuring to determine that?
That's an excellent question. I have looked into the metrics, and they included things like development. They included things like procurement of jobs and stability and those kinds of things. But I'd have to go back through it's been a little while since I've looked at those metrics to give you them in detail. So I won't yammer on too much about them at the risk of being too vague.
Well, fair enough. And you did mention that a bunch of this information is online, so we can yes. We could maybe go do some homework ourselves and look into that.
Absolutely. It'll come up very quickly. Yeah.
Now, you are specifically active with a group called Community Wealth Candidates. Can you tell us a bit more about what that's about?
Absolutely. So Community Wealth Candidates works both with organizations and local activist groups and with politicians at all levels of government. We provide education work around community wealth building, but the other big thing that we do, and organizational work, we do help community activists organize around community wealth building, but the other big thing that we do is we endorse candidates. And we endorsed a bunch of candidates during the federal election, and now we are working on municipal elections across Ontario. And we endorse candidates who support initiatives that are good for community wealth building. Now, we've made a recommended pledge for community wealth candidates, for municipal candidates, that we've just released in the last handful of days. So if people want to check out our website or want to check out our Twitter or Facebook, you'll see this pledge. And it's twofold. There are two main things that we are looking for municipal community wealth candidates. The first is that they would support grants to community land trusts and worker cooperatives. And the second is that they will start a committee on community wealth building that is focused on bringing together anchor institutions that will subscribe to an ethos of hire local, buy local, live local. Those are the two things that we are looking for. We make some suggested numbers and we make some suggested ways of getting going on that. All of this is negotiable. We also have some people who have inquired about being in two-tiered governments. Some of them are, we have some, like in Niagara where I am, we have city councils and we have a municipal council as well. And so they ask, you know, some of this might not be shaped directly to our local environment. We make a number of other initiatives, some of which we've talked about today, like employee ownership centers, pledges to donate underused land to community land trusts, things like that, that can be worked into a pledge. So if there are candidates, interested candidates in getting an endorsement from us, listening, who might go, I don't know if this works with our city council or with our current structure. Have a look at our website. There are other options. We can talk, we can figure something out. But those are the two main things that we look for in a municipal community wealth candidate. Will they support grants for worker cooperatives and community land trusts? And will they work to bring together anchor institutions for community wealth building that will buy local, hire local, and live local? And we will provide endorsements for candidates who subscribe to a community wealth foundation.
Fantastic. And do you have any candidates that you've endorsed already? Can you tell me a bit about that?
We currently are talking with six incumbent city councilors finalizing endorsements. And because we do ask everybody who's going to become a candidate to make a statement, we ask them to make a positive statement, but one that is clear about what they're on the record standing for. We are currently finalizing those statements with six candidates from four different municipalities. And that's been a pretty fast response, as we only released the official call a handful of days ago for municipal candidates. I will say this, at the present moment, because it's harder for us to reach out to the insurgent candidates, we are talking exclusively at the present moment with incumbents. And incumbents are great. You know, they have a high likelihood of getting reelected. They have high profile. They're connected. They have experience. They know some of the ropes. But insurgent candidates are very important too. They're often challenging the most corrupt actors on city council. They're often people who are connected to different communities, who are going to be engaged in politics for many years to come. And so we are really trying to do more to reach out to the insurgent candidates, which was much easier to do with the federal election because it was a lot easier to figure out who was going to run. Whereas right now, there are a lot of people who are still thinking about running for council who don't have their names listed anywhere. And so any help that can be provided reaching out to prospective candidates for municipal government and city government, we really appreciate that. So please pass our name on to anybody you know who might be thinking of running for city council and see if they would be interested in being a community wealth candidate. We'd love to arrange an endorsement.
Excellent, excellent.
And I'll mention that we are currently talking to incumbent candidates in Guelph as well.
Okay, great. No, that's good to hear. Very encouraging. Yeah, this is somewhat of a tangent, but it just occurred to me, you were mentioning that, you know, sort of the first step in the community wealth is to kind of sit down and take an assessment of what anchor institutions or other things are available in the community mm-hmm. already that can be leveraged. And it occurs to me that the Ontario Cooperative Association, their offices are here in Guelph.
Well, that's as good as it's going to get, right?
And our business school at the university very much brands itself as like, oh, we're the good business school, the non-corporate business school. But as far as I know, they don't have any dedicated cooperative business courses. So maybe that's something we can fix.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't have any other particular questions. Was there anything else you wanted to bring up or mention that we haven't gotten to yet?
I really love the questions that you ask, Kevin. I hope I've spoken to community wealth building clearly, but if there's anything that is unclear to people, I'm very happy to do follow-up questions and take some from the audience.
here's a hypothetical. Suppose the community is hyper-focused on employment, good employment rates, reducing unemployment and getting good jobs, but they're not so focused on the environment. That potentially be a problem, or are these not opposing goals? Or
I haven't even spoken about the environment yet. I have not had enough coffee this morning. Wow. Yes, thank you so much for that question. This is so important. I mean, it's astonishing. In the last federal election, Canadians listed the climate crisis as their number one concern, which was astonishing to me. In the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a housing crisis, the number one thing that got listed was the environment. And yet so many people feel like they have no method of taking action on the environment because the powers that be are so big and amorphous. And community wealth building is really a way of escaping the sense of impotence that we sometimes face in this world of global neoliberalism when it comes to the environment. There are a handful of things here. First off, our usual models of economic development are based on an idea of 3% compound growth per annum through extractive models, right? Through corporate models that are incredibly wasteful, unbelievably wasteful, and need constant growth under those extractive models in order to be sustainable. And so this leads locally to sprawl, to disinvestment from communities, and it leads at the national, international level to outsourcing. It leads to just plowing down communities into the phenomenon called throwaway cities, which St. Catharines, where I live, is one. The General Motors plant that used to be the hotbed for all of our employment here, the heart of our economy, has been this decaying factory abandoned in our downtown core for a decade. And we're going to have another 2 years before we have a report on what we think our next steps should be. Meanwhile, that activity has been relocated to Mexico, where a lot of that factory has been rebuilt in a different community with enormous ecological waste, in addition to all of the human waste that was thrown away in that process. And then what happens to the people who used to work there? Some of them turn into the opioid epidemic, of course. Others have to become commuters to other communities. And so the fossil fuel expenditures just keep on growing and growing and growing. And it's cyclical, these problems. Now, a community is not going to throw their own city away. The first thing that we're not doing that. We're not engaged in that wasteful 3% growth per annum on extractive structures model. We're not going to throw our own communities, our own factories into Mexico. We're not going to do that. And the other thing that we're doing is we're taking those resources and being able to use them in concerted ways. So what's really remarkable, you asked about some of the examples out there. I should delve a little further into what was done in Cleveland, because this is so important. The model was brought into a neighborhood in Cleveland where the median income was $18,500. We're talking about a deeply impoverished community. Half of their initial workforce at the worker cooperatives that they started there, which were employing initially about 75 people, half of their workforce were ex-felons because people were just desperate. The cooperatives that they started were cooperatives that were, one was installing solar panels, another was an urban farm that was using what's it called, hydroponic technology that's incredibly eco-friendly. Mm-hmm. Another was an industrial mm-hmm. laundromat that was using incredibly eco-friendly machinery. There was very, very little waste. And they were partnering that with, for instance, the Cleveland Clinic, which needed all kinds of gowns and sheets and things to be laundered. And they have grown to over 300 employees in a decade and a half. And they're actually now purchasing other companies and bringing them into this network. And so we had a lot of these people. This is one of those communities that was also largely communities of color that had been left behind in the post-industrial era. And so we had economic justice, racial and social justice, environmental justice, all of this happening at once which seems like a utopian idea. It seems like it would be an impossible thing to do. But by simply bringing these pieces together coherently, the worker cooperatives, the local funding for those cooperatives, and the anchor institutions in a coherent way, they were actually able to accomplish all of those things. And so when we talk about the environmental crisis, this kind of activity can be done on a very large scale, and it can speak to the most pressing issues in our community that are economic at the same time, as that fantastic question came in, you know, does job creation or housing creation, where so many people want us to trample our wetlands in order to create housing developments, right? Does this have to come at a cost of the environment in the face of a global climate disaster? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But we have to sit down around the table and look at how we can leverage our investment to get the kind of initiatives in our community that we want. And when we do that, then we can create fantastic jobs, even for the most underprivileged groups who are normally completely thrown away by the political system and the economic system. We can give them fantastic jobs. A lot of these people who are in that Cleveland model, who started as ex-felons, who thought their lives were destroyed, they thought they were done. They're now purchasing houses and saving for retirement. They've got their whole lives back as democratic worker owners contributing to society. They've got self-esteem, they've got dignity, respect in their communities. Their whole lives have been not just restored, but they're better than they've ever been before. Completely transformed lives. We're talking about saving lives here while saving the environment. So when we actually look at what our resources are and how we can leverage them in democratic local ways, yeah, we can job creation and saving the environment can be put together in a package deal very coherently. Fantastic question. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for that answer. That's really encouraging and inspiring that these things that often are juxtaposed as contradictory goals, you know, economic development and our climate concerns, it's nice to hear that that's kind of a false dichotomy.
Absolutely. 100%.
So we have another question from Barb Hogg. So the city of Guelph, there's a chunk of land on the edge of the city called the Old Reformatory Lands. It used to be a prison. It's not anymore. It's an abandoned, underused property, or at least the buildings are. The land itself is a very nice park area. It's got some big ponds and lots of walking trails. And there's been ongoing discussions for seemingly forever between the city and the province about, well, what are we going to do with these lands? Maybe the land bank or the community land trust is an option. So currently these lands are owned by the Ontario government, but they're not doing anything with it. And the city's concerned about what's going to happen to these lands. And I think the fear is that it would be, you know, sold off to some developer and then they build whatever they want.
Yeah. That's quite often where a community land trust steps in. And it you know, sometimes a municipal government has a piece of land kind of by default. And it sounds like that might be the kind of situation that you've got there, where they've got a piece of land that they don't exactly know what to do with. And everybody's maybe passing the buck. Oh, I don't know if it's my jurisdiction. Maybe this belongs with this other organization. And people can talk in circles around it for a very long time. Whereas when it's handed over to a local nonprofit democratic group, they're going to start seeing what positive progressive action in their community on that property is pretty quickly. They're going to start to see the opportunities in it pretty quickly. And in a way that will be inclusive, in a way that a private developer, you know, they're only going to take it. Often a private developer is only going to take it first off if the city gives them a hell of a deal, which usually means giving a lot of city resources over to that private developer. And then what's going to be created out of that is probably an extractive resource from there. And so usually the best result you're going to get from that is gentrification. That's the best result. you might get much worse than gentrification out of it. That's a fantastic opportunity to get a community land trust involved. And for people who are interested in being part of community land trusts to speak up and get involved on the advocacy side of things as well.
Excellent. Thank you for that. I've got another question from Hugh Whiteley. He mentioned there's an urban First Nation reserve in Winnipeg that apparently announced a tax agreement with the city of Winnipeg, and that will allow the First Nation to undertake a large development project to benefit members of the reserve.
Yeah.
Is this perhaps another example of, or are you aware of other examples of urban reserves acting sort of as a community land trust?
Yes. Now, I will say I'm less familiar with some of the things that are happening in Canada, but this is a big thing that's happening in the United States right now. And a lot of Indigenous groups in the United States are seeing community land trusts as being a contemporary practice that is very in keeping with their longstanding traditions around land use. And so community land trusts are now in the United States. I don't know if they're taking off in Canada to the same extent. I haven't seen it in Canada taking off as a kind of method of reconciliation that maybe it should be in Canada. But yes, this is being taken up more and more by Indigenous groups as a method of reconciliation, and as a method of fostering reconciliation, and as a method of engaging in practices that speak to their cultural roots. And that's something that's really important about community wealth work, is it allows us to see the building blocks can be applied sort of universally, but they're about leveraging our unique local resources, our unique local flavors and intelligences. And what we see with Indigenous groups who are engaging in community land trust work, they're engaging with it in a very rounded cultural sense. They're bringing a history to community land trusts that is quite remarkable. The groups that are engaging with that are finding that very, very meaningful. So that's something that communities can also look to do as they look at how they, if a municipal government has underused lands that they are thinking about donating to community land trusts, they could very well think about how that might fit within a reconciliation agenda if they have Indigenous groups in their community that they can partner with on that. I think we're going to see a lot more of that in Canada in the years to come. I certainly hope so.
What is the benefit of being a community wealth candidate? Like, what do you, Colin, offer someone who takes the pledge to become a community wealth candidate?
Yeah, fantastic. So we do post our endorsements through all of our social media, and that was very useful to federal candidates who could then in turn reshare that through their other social media platforms. But the other thing that we do is we provide ongoing resources for education and research that those candidates might need. So we the first thing that we do is we help promote those candidates, and we provide them with that endorsement, which also, because we ask candidates to make a statement with that we then promote, that also means that they can engage their constituents on the kind of community wealth initiatives that they're supporting, and that education can reach the people that they're working with in their community as well. But then we keep an ongoing relationship with those candidates, and we're there to help them with community wealth work in any way that they see fit. And they often do turn to us to do continued research. And we're continuing to work with some of the federal community wealth candidates who got elected on work with getting resources for worker cooperatives right now at the federal level. So we do keep an ongoing relationship, and we do act as an ongoing resource for community wealth candidates in addition to the promotional work that we do for their campaigns.
Okay, thank you. And another question goes back to anchoring institutions. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, buy local, hire local. And so the question is, you would try to maximize buying local. Because not everything can be, right? Obviously textbooks and big medical supplies and whatnot. But that would that also include buying from what I would call ethical companies?
Big time. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the buy local focus is important in general, even if we're not yet bringing things like worker-owned companies and cooperatives into the picture. One of the things that we saw when we probably all maybe remember this from various communities. I think Guelph actually managed to insulate a little better than some of the others. But in a lot of the places that I've lived in the past, I've lived in a couple places of Niagara as well as Toronto, downtown districts completely disappeared when the big box stores came in. And one of the things that we saw happen as a result was that some of the small businesses that no longer had that core clientele, some of the things that they did that were more communitarian, like supporting kids' sports teams or other nonprofit cultural initiatives in the area, that stuff started to dissipate as well because the big box stores didn't care about that stuff. And so buying local is even within, if we don't have any worker-owned companies and worker cooperatives, although I think actually Guelph has a handful of worker cooperatives already in the city, which is rare, not very many do. But even if we didn't have any of those kinds of structures in our community, we could already do quite a lot just by buying local and hiring local to produce opportunities for our citizens. But then it becomes possible to take that to the next step, start developing worker-owned companies, worker cooperatives, purchasing from them, and making prosperous, democratic, local jobs a permanent fixture of our community.
Thank you. And just as a general comment, it seems to me, I mean, more and more of us are realizing that, you know, the whole free trade and globalization movement really was not a good deal for most. Yeah. And this community wealth building is trying to hone our attention onto the local community.
Yes.
So I think this is an excellent an excellent response to the wake-up call that we are being given.
Great.
So thank you very much for talking about that with us.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Susan had a comment, and I think it's too late to get into it, but it would be for call, and it's to do with how, I guess, the co-op model might not work in some places because it only helps a few people and not more, and that there was something to do with getting rid of our class system that would have to be a bigger solution.
Right. I see her comment. It's structurally impossible for everyone in a capitalist economy to own their own little business. Mm-hmm. Either the labor force will collectively control the means of production, or they'll be dominated by capitalists who extract their surplus labor.
Yes, yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. The labor that goes not towards meeting their own needs, but toward the remainder of a firm's revenues, which, whether kept by the capitalists or reinvested, is out of the workers' control. The only way for all workers to be free is to free humanity from class society.
Yeah, I think I think at the ultimate level, I pretty well agree with that statement. I will say that when it comes to cooperative enterprise, if I can just make sure I'm both zooming in and zooming out the lens, because one of the things about community wealth work is it can operate on any kind of scale, very, very small to help a few people, or as we're seeing some communities already leveraging hundreds of millions of dollars worth of community wealth work. The cooperative enterprise is, I think, the positive expansion of what people sometimes get in self-employment, where they have that autonomy, but they have no way of scaling it. Cooperative enterprise is where that it becomes possible to scale it. And we see small little worker cooperatives that operate very well, but also huge ones. I mentioned Mondragon, which has over 80,000 workers in one network. The ones in Cleveland are getting very big. Cooperative Home Care Associates started with a dozen employees in 1985. Today they're they're in the thousands. So they do scale very large. John Lewis Partnership, which is another democratic worker-owned model, over 80,000 workers. So they can get to very large scales. But then we also have to look at the other side of things and talk about public banks and credit unions and non-capitalist modes of finance, so that it isn't the case that we have to get the finance going back to those centrally controlled capitalist powers. If we want to start talking about if we're starting to talk about the next system, what are we reproducing over the next 25 years? That means that 25 years from now, we're talking about a different kind of economy. And so community wealth work can be used at a very small scale to just help some people in need. But it also is talking about changing what we're reproducing, not just producing. And that can allow us to engage in some larger systemic conversations as well. That's a very quick answer to a very big proposal there, but I hope it starts to speak to some of it a little bit. Thank you very much for that.
Do you have any closing remarks for us?
So the last things that I would say are simply that we have resources on our website. We also have a YouTube playlist. Over the past 9 months, we've done interviews with political economists, with local practitioners, and with politicians on community wealth building strategies. And so for people who are interested in delving in more, we have a playlist of about 7 videos on YouTube that a lot of people are finding very handy. And we recently produced a video with political economist Vijay Kumar on community wealth. We called it community. We daringly called it community wealth and the coming recession because we felt some ominous clouds looming. And since then, it seems like every news item about the economy is terrible. And so it's just becoming more and more relevant. It wasn't our hope that it would become more and more relevant, but it seems that it is. And it's really looking at how community wealth building, focusing on community wealth building's way of building resilience, which is going to be, I think, a big word that we're going to have to talk about in the coming years. So I encourage people to check out that interview. And again, if people are interested or know people who might be interested in being candidates coming up, please have them get in contact with us. Even if you feel like you don't know enough about community wealth building yet to jump in as a community wealth candidate, we will answer any questions, provide any educational resources that people need, and we'll make that available to anyone who's interested. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time, Colin. We really appreciate it. And we wish you well with your endeavors. And Tanya, did you have any closing announcements for us before we call it a day?
We've got Have Your Say with regards to the OR lands, which we talked a little bit about today. What do you like about the OR lands and what are to you the most important sites? Where are they and why? Please have your say by June the 22nd. So have your say about the Edinburgh Rail Crossing. There are 2 virtual follow-up sessions, Monday, June 20th at 6:30, Wednesday, June 22nd at 2:30. Please go to the Have Your Say website to get the links and make any of your comments by June the 29th. June 21st is National Indigenous Day. And there's going to be a national celebration of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples at Riverside Park on June 21st from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, it is an open mic session. We would like to know what is on your mind. Thank you all for being here and see you next week. Make sure you bring your open minds to the open mic.
And that's all for today. Thanks to the Breezy Breakfast team of Kevin Bowman, Morgan Dandy, Tanya Gaybard, and Phil Out. Music's provided by Juice Germ. I'm Jia Yuyan, producer of the Breezy Breakfast Show.